Thank you very much for coming. We have the great privilege tonight to hear Rabbi Natov, Francis Natov, our educational director of the David Cardozo Academy. I can assure you that the topic will be highly unusual and most engaging. This is by the very definition that is part of our school, and also because of the personality, he happens to be a good friend and a great teacher and a very important thinker. Rabbi Natov is going to discuss some issues related to the Islam world and how to deal with it. I have no clue what he's going to say, which makes it all more exciting. And we hope you have a beautiful learning, inspiring, or better, a very beautiful, inspiring, that was the word I was looking for, evening, which I'm sure you will have.
Thank you, Cardozo. I thank the Academy for giving me the opportunity to speak about this topic. This topic I've been working on, or related topic, for much of the year, and being able to actually present it to an intelligent and interested audience that we, such as what we have at the Academy, is an additional treat for me. I'm going to start right off by giving you a set of quotes. And on purpose, I've let these quotes... let's start over again.
No, we should be good. Go ahead.
Let me start over. We should mention the fact that this evening, great Talmid Chacham, a Jewish leader, passed away. And I'm sure most people have heard of Mordechai Eliyahu, passed away only a few hours ago. And whatever Torah will be contained in the speech, which is primarily Chokhmah as opposed to Torah, and perhaps the Chokhmah also should be dedicated to Ilui Nishmato. We want to start the class, the presentation, by making you go through a certain exercise with me. I'm going to give you a piece of paper with a series of quotes on them. And the idea, and perhaps it might be easy for people familiar with the Academy, the idea is to identify the speaker of, the writer actually, of these particular passages. But what I'm going to ask you to do is to do it silently. Don't blurt anything out and give it away for others who might have more interest in it than yourself. So I'm just going to pause, and perhaps a few more people will come in the middle, if people can pass these around. You can write them down. You can maybe share with your neighbor ideas that you might have. You can please read them to yourselves. Again, don't blurt any answers or guesses out. The idea is to identify the writer. I see not everyone will be familiar necessarily with all the writers from all the quotes, but give it your best shot. You're ready to find out who they are, you can raise your hand. I'll pass it a different sheet with identification of these people. So if you're ready, just raise your hand. Again, don't blurt it out. See the answers. Keep it to yourself.
It's all for you, right?
Well, one of them is. Sort of. Okay, for the answers?
Qualifying
crappy.
Sorry?
Did
not have any answers.
No, that's fine, that's fine. You'll probably be right if you don't have any of the answers. Okay, those of you who are not yet ready should get ready, because I think I'm going to pass out.
That's the answer, though?
Well, yeah. I mean, you can compare the two sets of pages. Okay. Okay, please pass back the back to people who haven't seen yet the answers. Did you guys get over here? Pass back. Anybody not get over there? Okay. Now, the first set of quotes. Decide if I'm sitting or standing tonight. I think I'm going to sit. It's my permission. The first set of quotes are all by modernist Islamic scholars. The idea was, of course, that you could easily confuse them with modernist Jewish scholars. And to make that point, in the second sheet, you find accompanying the first set of quotes, not all four, actually only three of them. You find quotes from Jewish scholars that closely, I mean, we probably could have gotten even closer, but closely resemble the points that these Muslim scholars are making about Sharia, I'm probably mispronouncing that, Islamic law. Very similar to the sort of issues that we're discussing in Halakha. The first set of quotes, the Muslim quote being from a very famous up-and-coming, is already come, is very famous in the United States as a law professor and a spokesman for the Islamic community in the United States, Khaled Abul Fadl, who's written many books in English. And in this particular quote, he's complaining about what Tamar Ross calls, in a different statement, legal halachic positivism, meaning that halacha is it. There's nothing else to obeying God except for observing the halacha. And the more perfect your technical performance of the halacha, the better a person you are. That's what he's speaking and complaining about and accusing Puritans, which I translated into our terms, right, in the first page, right? I highlighted the words that I changed. Obviously, I couldn't let the words give it away, but the Islamic Puritans we call, in Jewish world, Haredim. Or in Professor Ross's quote, she actually speaks about many of Rabbi Soloveitchik's students who straddle perhaps the Haredi world, at least the ones that she's speaking about in this particular context. The next two quotes are paralleled by things that are closer to home in the David, things that have been said in the Beit Midrash of Amram Avinu, in the David Cardozo Academy. Second set of quotes being about the notion of spirit of the law, which has been lost, again, according to Subi Mahmasani, who I know actually very little about, a Lebanese scholar and jurist who wrote this actually several decades ago, so I don't know if he's even alive, but I love the quotes. I had to bring it even if I know little about him. In any case, speaking about the lack of spirit in religious law, in his case in Islam, in the case of Rabbi Cardozo, speaking about halacha. I skipped number three. Number three is actually from another famous scholar who's not identified in the second page, and his name is Fazlur Rahman. He's a Pakistani scholar, actually also is living in the West, just like Khaled Abul Fadl, who's, forgot to mention, is a law professor at UCLA in Los Angeles. I'm not sure where Fazlur Rahman is nowadays. I know he's in Oxford and Chicago. Regardless, his beef is one that is similar to beefs of, as I said, progressive Orthodox Jewish thinkers, that there's no philosophy, there's no thought in orthodoxy. He uses the word orthodoxy, by the way, so I didn't even have to change that. But he wasn't speaking about Jewish orthodoxy, he was speaking about Muslim Orthodoxy. And then finally, the set of quotes where I had the audacity to include myself, along with the great Mahmoud Mohammed Taha. And I don't know if anyone else will ever include me in combination with him, so I had to do it myself. Was truly actually of the people mentioned, he's not a professor, and perhaps from what I know about him, really a saint, a tzaddik in terms of his religious life and behavior, a true religious teacher who died, I shouldn't say, I don't know if I can say Kiddush Hashem, but died as a religious martyr in his Sudanese homeland. And he had a whole following, very interesting, his whole thesis. I mean, we don't have time tonight to go through the various theses. All of these people are coming from different places, but the one thing they have in common is they're trying to understand the interface between modernity and Islam. And in that case, I thought it was very appropriate to, first of all, introduce this world to us, to make us realize that such people exist. And to show you that not only do they exist, they're discussing a lot of the same things that we are discussing within Judaism. That's not to deny real differences that do exist between Islam and Judaism. But at the same token, we tend to, whenever we're interested in other religions, perhaps because of the political situation, we tend to ignore Islam and either go to Christianity, which has somehow taken much more of an impact and influence on Jewish culture in the last 200 years. And if it's not Christianity that we're interested in, then it's usually Eastern religions. In fact, because of its similarity to Judaism, I think there's much more to learn from the Islamic experience than from any other world religions. And this is what I propose to do this evening in a very small and focused way. I should say that if anybody saw the title and came to hear about politics or to hear me badmouth Islam, which oftentimes that's what Jews, when they speak about Islam, get together to do, you'll be disappointed. So if you want to leave now, you can get your money back at the door. And maybe we'll do that a different time. Hopefully not. In any case, truth is, I should put my cards on the table, as I think is appropriate to do, that my feelings towards Islam, and even the fundamentalist version with certain reservations, is primarily positive. And again, that may seem unusual in the context of Jewish society, in the context of Jewish culture, and perhaps that's an unfortunate part of the fallout of the conflict that we're involved in here in our region. The last few days have been particularly difficult ones in this conflict. But at the same time, I don't think it should blind us towards the beauty that does exist in Islam as well as in other world religions. And having read a little bit more over the last several months about Islam, I've come to appreciate the values that have made it an attractive, powerful, and very large world religion. Values such as loyalty to God, values such as self-negation, the concept of equality in front of God, the complete, or I shouldn't say complete, but comparative lack of racism or nationalism that classically exists in Islam. But again, that's for a different time, that's for a crash course. I'm just putting my bias on the table. My bias, I don't think so. Bias is simply where I'm coming from. Okay, so how did I come to Islam and these various scholars, and what does that have to do with modern Orthodoxy? So the truth is, this year's plan, I've been on a half sabbatical. I've been given the opportunity to do my own private research, and what I was planning to do was, which I have done, is to research the relationship between religion and state in the various religious traditions. And my hope on a more practical level was to put out two serious articles by this time, or certainly to have written two serious articles by this time. This is 10 months into the project. But I ran into an immediate obstacle. The first article I had planned to write was going to be about a Jewish analysis of John Locke's theory of separation between religion and state, which is not really accurately described as separation of religion and state, as much more, I mean, the famous work that he wrote is a letter on toleration. Really what he's speaking about is the, as far as he's concerned, the impossibility of forcing someone to follow a religion that they don't believe. And therefore, the complete counterproductivity of what was going on in his time, where various states, I mean, were already past the Reformation, but still in England as well as in other countries, there's a lot of religious conflict going on with a high cost in lives and even higher cost in instability. And as a result, Locke writes his famous letter saying that governments should give up the idea of forcing their religion on the citizens, on the subjects of that state. In any case, I wanted to see, well, what does Judaism have to say about this letter on toleration? We had an exercise once. I don't know if anybody was with me when we did it in class several years back in the academy. And so I thought I had to start something interesting that no one else had done, and I was ready to start my project. But I ran into an immediate obstacle, finding out that I'd been beaten by about 3 years, right? Only 3 years. That someone by the name of Jonathan Cohen at the University of Maine had already beat me and written the exact article that I was going to write. And it's a good article, so I recommend that people take a look at it. In fact, since I was going to write the same thing, so I got to think it's a good article. He starts his article from an interesting place, though, and this is where I'm going to start tonight's real discussion. He quotes someone who, if you haven't heard of, you're probably better off. Someone by the name of Andrew Sullivan. And if you have heard of him, you know why you're better off. And if you haven't heard of him, you'll probably Google it as soon as you get home. But in any case, Andrew Sullivan, without getting into his background, writes or wrote immediately after 9/11 an article addressing Islamic society, as many people did back then, some pro, some con. He wasn't so positive. And he writes, why can't there be an Islamic Locke? Why can't there be someone in Islamic society who comes and has the same sort of watershed impact on Islamic society about the separation of religion and politics? Right, according to Sullivan, if that could be possible, there wouldn't be any 9/11s. There wouldn't be any flotillas. There wouldn't be any of the problems that we have with radical Arab or Muslim, for that matter, politics. Because Arabs, after all, is only a subgroup of the problem that exists. Exists in Pakistan, it exists in Indonesia, and in the Philippines, all throughout the world. The issue of Muslim radicalism is an issue. So says Sullivan, why can't there just be a Muslim Locke? And obviously that was a rhetorical flourish meant to put down Islam, consciously or unconsciously. And whether it was meant to do that certainly is what it accomplished. Now, Jonathan Cohen, who quoted, the fellow who wrote the article that I was going to write about Judaism and John Locke, only used that himself as a way of getting attention. Now, you get more attention if you're speaking about Muslims than if you're speaking about Jews. Everybody speaks about Jews. But Muslims, everybody's excited and wants to know what's going on, especially, this was already several years after 9/11, but post 9/11 there's much more discussion, much more writing about Islam and Muslims. In any case, Jonathan Cohen wasn't really interested in the question of Muslim Locke. He was interested in the parallel question. He says, well, if Andrew Sullivan asked the question about a Muslim lock, maybe we should ask the question about a Jewish lock. Can there be a Jewish lock? Can there be someone in Judaism who says to the Jewish people and has an influence on them to separate between politics and state? And the answer is more nuanced than I'm going to present it.
Religion and state or politics?
I'm sorry, I said politics? Religion and state. Thank you. So someone's listening. Baruch Hashem. Okay. Everybody else is too polite to interrupt. But in any case, yeah, the question that Jonathan Cohen asks is, can there be a Jewish law who separates between politics on the one hand and Jewish religion on the other hand? As I said, the answer is nuanced, but his answer is basically no. And from that perspective, I think it's fairly a no-brainer that if you look into what Locke says in his arguments, it's very difficult to make the same arguments that Locke is making from a Jewish perspective, even though perhaps other arguments can be made and certainly have been made. But in any case, what I want to do tonight is sort of backtrack and ask whether the Muslim law question is really perhaps the way to the Jewish law question. In other words, not just to skip it, but to investigate why, in fact, isn't there a Muslim law? And perhaps from that we'll understand better why it's difficult for there to be a Jewish law, meaning someone who's going to separate from within Judaism religion and state. By the way, Sullivan's not just saying there should be a Muslim, and Cohen's not just saying there should be a Jewish fellow who stands up or sits down and writes articles and letters why Judaism really has nothing to do with politics, or Islam has nothing to do with politics. Sullivan is talking about someone who's going to influence Islamic society. Cohen is speaking about someone who's going to influence Jewish society to accept that change, in the same way that Locke was a powerful transitional figure and was able to change the way the relationship between the state and religion was viewed in Christian society. Before I do it, one more point by way of introduction, and the title had to do with modern orthodoxy, and I haven't gotten to that yet, but my whole point, at least tonight, is to, from this issue, attempt a critique of certain aspects of modern orthodoxy, and I do that as someone who identifies with modern orthodoxy, very strongly, in fact. I do a critique because I think that anybody involved in any group should critique their own group more than any other one. In the same way that personally we have an obligation to critique ourselves much more than we critique others, I think the same is true about our in-group, about our nation, that it's very easy to critique others, much more difficult and yet much more productive to critique ourselves. But because it's much easier to critique others, I'm going to critique ourselves via modernist Islam. Because it's much easier to be objective and not to have anything pending, any sort of loyalty to modernist Islam that will prevent us from being more objective in our critique. And once we have that critique, right, so then we have to go back and look at ourselves. Okay, so that's the introductions. I think I'm halfway done, but we started a few minutes late, so I'm going to take a few minutes at the end as well to try to give you the presentations that should be presented. Now, as I said, there have been Muslims, as we saw, and these people, Abu al-Fadl, through this, all of these people are dealing with issues of a gentler Islamic politics, which would, in most of these cases, render the type of Islamic hardcore political activism something of the past, and certainly are opposed to fundamentalist, what are called fundamentalist streams in Islam. These people exist, as we said at the beginning of the presentation. They're out there. The question is, if they remain what we call wannabes, they want to be locks, they want to change their society, why are they not successful? What is blocking them from success? And though I'm going to focus on the political question, the modernist project in Islam is very similar to the modernist project in Judaism. They're dealing with other questions outside of church or mosque and state. They're dealing with issues of truth claims that are challenged by academic study, as well as academic methodology, challenging traditional ways of coming to grasp with concepts, parochial values that are at odds with what is supposed to be universalistic Western thinking, the question of tolerance in the global village, right? All these issues are being dealt by these people also, just like these are issues that we're dealing with in Judaism. But again, and I think it's important to point that out, but again, what we're going to focus on tonight is really the political question, because I think the point is brought out most dramatically there. What I want to really look at is what is stopping these people that we mentioned before, and that we'll mention more of, the Islamic modernists, who are serious scholars, who have followers. They're not simply names that I had to hunt to find some crazy Muslim in some far-flung part of the world who would say something liberal. These are serious people, and they have followers. The question is, if they are serious people and they have followers, why are they not more successful? And I just want to give a few illustrations of how I see that they're not successful. Obviously, it's the subject of a lengthy study, and it's not something that's a unanimous conclusion of all scholarship, but I think the illustrations make the point such that people who disagree, I think, are engaging in wishful thinking. In any case, we mentioned this fellow at UCLA, Khaled Abu al-Fadl. This is one of the books that he has put out. And I don't think it's in this book. I think it's one of his other books. I've read, I think, most of them at this point. He complains about not being published in Arabic. I want you to think about what that means, right? This is an Islamic scholar who's trying to influence the Islamic world. And he complains that one of his books, and probably many of his books, are not being published at all in Arabic, that attempts to publish it, or to partially publish it in Arabic, are met with very serious opposition. Another modernist, in fact, the person who we saw, the last quote, who speaks about the evolution or the need for evolution in Islamic law, on the sources that I handed out. So his foremost talmid, his foremost student, is also professor at an American university. His name is Abdullahi An-Naim, he's also from the Sudan. And he was able to get his work translated into Arabic, and it was published by no less a controversial institution than the American University in Cairo, right? Also should spell out the type of influence he's likely to get when the only publishing house that will take such a book is the American University in Cairo. Of course, An-Naim is clever enough to realize that this could be a problem in terms of the influence he can have. And he says as follows, it may appear presumptuous to expect a book that is written in English, he's not talking about the Arabic translation, it may be presumptuous to expect a book that is written in English and is likely to be banned in some Muslim countries to have any significant impact in the Muslim world. And to which I would answer, yes. it is presumptuous to think that it's going to have impact in the Muslim world. Of course, Anaim answers with a rather lame and vague hope that eventually a conducive climate will materialize, and one day, in the not-too-distant future, people will read Anaim and find out what his teacher said and adopt a gentler, kinder Islam, which also it preaches a more modern understanding of the state, which is divorced from radical Islamic politics and is tolerant of minorities and certainly tolerant of women, and so on and so forth. But in the meantime, it's only a hope that such a climate will materialize. And in the meantime, most of his readers are living in North America and in Europe. Speaking about Al-Fadl's essay, actually a different essay, not this one, but an essay on Islam and tolerance, this is about Islam and democracy, some Western Islamic scholars say about Abu Fadl's work, for example, Milton Forrest says as follows: it will be studied with interest in the outside world, where not coincidentally Al-Fadl lives and works. In the Muslim world, is likely to be ignored, if not vilified. Or Stanley Kurtz says, this is, I think, putting the arrow right on the mark, he says that this approach may be popular at liberal schools of divinity. Right? Liberal schools of divinity, like Harvard Divinity School. Right? If you ever read Ari Goldman's book, With God in Harvard, you'll get a good flavor of what a liberal divinity school is, right? He speaks about all sorts of religious and sexual and other commitments that the people in the school have. And these are the type of people, says Kurtz, that are going to eat up Abu Fadl's treatment of Islam and tolerance, of Islam and democracy, and so on and so forth. He says also departments of religion at American universities, but I wonder how much appeal it will have for Middle Eastern Muslims. By contrast, I brought another book called Milestones by a fellow named Saeed Katoub. I don't know if anybody's heard the name. A couple of people have heard of him. He was a leader of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. He's viewed in this particular book as viewed as a foundation stone of a fundamentalist Islam. The Brotherhood was not a terrorist organization, but certainly, as it was said, is something that you will find on the bookshelves of people like people belonging to Al-Qaeda. And this book, though it looks very simple, right, whereas this book looks, Al-Fadl's is all nice and fancy, published by Boston University. This is published by some printing house in Damascus. There's no date of print. But as opposed to this book, which probably has only sold a few thousand copies at most, this book has sold millions of copies and has had over 2,000 editions, most of them in Arabic. Right, and obviously has had the concomitant influence on Islamic thought. Even on Amazon, I played around on Amazon, which I those of us who are addicted to the internet know about playing with different sites. So I wanted to see, certainly at least on Amazon, Al-Fadl will rank higher than Kitab. But the truth is he was beaten by 50,000 places. Kitab came in on 200,000 and he came in 250,000. My book 650,000 by comparison. Although I had to do the next thing is to put Mein Kampf over there. Mein Kampf I think was 6,000, which is a scary thing to know, but certainly much more popular in Amazon than, sorry?
Where is it popular?
I didn't see. We're talking about the United States. It's the American Amazon site. Okay.
And
Kitab's
book, when was it published?
I don't know. I don't remember when it was originally written. I think in the '50s or '60s. But it's become a classic. And we'll speak about why that's the case. But my point is that those that say that the moderate thinkers like Al-Fadl, and he's truly celebrated in the United States as a light and a beacon and a new ray of hope in the Muslim world, this is, from my perspective, at this point, a pipe dream. It's not something that is something that can be taken very seriously. On the other hand, Islamic fundamentalist thinkers are more popular than ever. And it's, again, hard to see that the trend will change in the near future. Now, getting back to Sullivan's question, Andrew Sullivan's question, why can't there be a Muslim John Locke? What he's really saying, what he's really asking, is under what circumstances does religious reinterpretation succeed? When can people take a tradition and a set of texts and interpret them in a new way and get away with it, or more than get away with it, succeed in convincing large numbers of people to follow their understanding of a religious tradition? And I should say right away that my perspective is that religious reinterpretation is not necessarily illegitimate. I don't think we should necessarily think of it as pasul. What reinterpreters claim, and they do so generally sincerely, is all they're doing is going back to the original understanding of a text and tradition. They're not being mechadesh, they're not bringing something new, as much as bringing back the old, right? The phrase of Chazra, Atara LeYoshna, bringing back the old crown that's become popular in Sephardic circles, is the idea of reinterpretation. That somewhere the tradition went wrong, this is the claim of reinterpretation, and we're going back to the original, more correct message. And this is in fact the case of the most successful of such reinterpretive ventures, the venture started by John Luther in the Christian tradition. Martin Luther. What did I say? John Luther. Okay. Tired tonight. It's good. Another person's listening. I'll throw a few of these throughout the evening to make sure everybody's awake and catches one of them. In any case, John Calvin, but Martin Luther. The reinterpretation of Catholic doctrine, don't forget, Luther starts as a Catholic monk, an Augustinian monk. He's a devout Catholic who comes and looks at the tradition and says, something went wrong, we have to go back to the original sources. That's a very courageous thing to do. Courage or not, the point for this evening is that he not only got away with it, but along with those people that followed him, was eminently successful. And it's no coincidence that the modernists, the Islamic modernists, all speak about an Islamic reformation. In other words, they look at the reformation as a model. Reinterpretation can work. We can go back to the sources, look at them more carefully, and suggest a different meaning, and it might catch on. This is the hope, and it's a hope, by the way, that was expressed already in the previous century. Actually, it's two centuries ago now, in the 1800s, someone called Sayyid Jamal Din al-Afghani, who's one of the first Muslim modernists. And it's something that to this very day is quoted again and again as a hope that, you see, it can happen in another tradition, maybe it can happen in ours. The problem is that the comparison fails. The comparison fails, I think, for three major reasons. And I think these are the three reasons that are key to successful reinterpretation of tradition. And I think before I tell you what the three criteria are, I want to tell you what one of the criteria is not. One of the criteria is not a better or more accurate reading of the text or tradition. I think Tamar Ross, those of us who have been studying her book this year, Expanding the Palace, what is it called? Expanding the Palace of the Torah. She makes the point concerning women's aliyot, that the fact that a very well-researched and convincing article saying that halachically women should be permitted to have aliyot is not what's going to bring about a change in halacha. Because it's not just a question of who has a better reading of the text. It's a question of what, quote, does Judaism say, end quote. What does Judaism have to say about women's aliyot? Regardless of all the proofs that you can bring me, Judaism, meaning the community, as per Raz, has something to say. And the community changes its opinions, usually fairly slowly, and it changes opinions not only based on proofs, but based on all sorts of other things. So what are those other things? So I think on one level, though better and more accurate readings are not the issue, there has to be a kernel of support, more than a kernel. There has to be real support for the reinterpretation of a tradition. In other words, to use a negative example, and it's an example that I've seen, actually, believe it or not, in print, the idea that Judaism is really a paganist religion, that really the Torah is there to teach us to worship many gods, is going to be a very difficult sell. It's going to be a difficult sell in view of all the references that seem to go against this. It's a very difficult sell in terms of the tradition that speaks very strongly against it in all sorts of different ways. And therefore, when a writer or writers understand bedavka against what Chazal say, when it says v'yomer Elohim naseh Adam, that means Elohim is Elohim, the God said, never mind v'yomer, it doesn't matter, it should be Hashem. Why is it Elohim? It's plural. That means the God said, naseh, let us make man. There are many gods, and that's one of the proofs that the original tradition was really paganistic, was really not monotheistic, and such a case is put forward. As I said, it's not going to resonate because there's too much against it in the pre-existing tradition. On the other hand, when Luther speaks about two kingdoms, which is the beginnings of the liberal order, he speaks about separating between the spiritual world on the one hand, right, the spiritual world of religious interest, of personal prayer and introspection on the one hand, and the earthly kingdom on the other hand, which is the world of governments and punishments, and say that these two worlds really have very little to do with each other, he's following something that has basis, and perhaps strong basis, in the Christian tradition. We all know the famous quote that appears in all the synoptic gospels, right? Give unto Caesar what is Caesar, and give Caesar's, and give unto God what is God's. Obviously, this predates Luther by many, many centuries, and almost a millennium and a half, to be more exact. Now, to try to bring such concepts into Islam or Judaism, if they don't exist or they have very shallow basis in foundational texts and in tradition, is not going to resonate with most of the committed Jewish community or most of the committed Islamic community. I could add to this Charles Liebman's argument. Charles Liebman is a very interesting writer, actually passed away a few years ago. He's at Bar-Ilan University for many years. Wrote the most in English, in the English language, about Israel and religion. And it says a lot of very interesting and I think intelligent things about it. He also wrote some articles that were not directly connected to Israel, using Israel as a test case for a thesis that he has that the fundamentalist interpretation of religious tradition are usually the most authentic. In other words, and he was a staunchly modern Orthodox Jew, nonetheless wrote this in the famous collection, Appleby, I forgot the other author, on fundamentalism in religion, trends towards fundamentalism, etc. In any case, Liebman writes that in general, trying to reinterpret something is usually going to be less close to the mark than the more conservative approach that has been handed down via tradition, even if with all sorts of emendations and with all sorts of changes. So that's issue number one. And the real issue, perhaps I've confused it by bringing Liebman, but the real issue is there a basis for the reinterpretation? Is there a strong basis for the reinterpretation in the text and in the tradition? Number two is the issue of piety and sincere religiosity. Now, we can hate Luther because of his anti-Semitism. We can bring all sorts of issues about, you know, his tormented life, which sometimes reminds us of Jews with tormented lives, like Lahavdil, Rabbi Nachman. But be that as it may, Luther was sincere, and again, was extremely courageous. You don't stand up in his time to the entire Catholic Church unless you really believe in something. And that was clear to his followers. The piety of the leaders, and it's not just Luther, it's Calvin and others as well, has to be matched by piety of followers, of fellowship as well. In other words, for something to succeed, people have to see that people are preaching it as well as following it because they really believe in it. Not because of any material advantage or political advantage that they may receive. And in fact, people who are involved in new religions in general have much to lose by being involved in new religions. Politically, socially, economically. So chances are you really believe in something in order to follow it. And that, I think, has an impact on the credibility of your reinterpretation. Compare that, by the way, to the modernists who are writing primarily in the West, to a Western audience, who may get a promotion at UCLA, and certainly gets many, many speaking engagements, as a result of taking a liberal position. Now, I don't want to question, and I believe that Al-Fadl, for example, who I'm speaking about, is a very sincere Muslim. I think most of the modernists appear to me as very sincere and pious individuals. But by the same token, the willingness to put oneself on the line is simply not there. And as a result, the motivation comes into question. As a result, they're less convincing to a fellowship. And the result of that is that there is not an impassioned fellowship that follows. In fact, Al-Fadl himself mentions this as a problem. By the way, in Tamaras as well, in some of my own writings, and other people's have mentioned as well, the analogy in Judaism, I think, is quite clear. I've mentioned before that a posek who has a clear sense of Yirat Shamayim, a palpable sense of Yirat Shamayim that's felt by the tzibur, that's felt by the Jewish people, is able to get away with much more. Much, much more. Like Rav Moshe Feinstein, for example. then someone who is Yirat Shamayim is questioned and therefore cannot move as far. Right? Certain leaders in the conservative movement who have suggested less radical things than Rav Moshe Feinstein were not accepted simply because there was a sense that of lack of Yirat Shamayim, of piety, of the leader, and importantly also of the followers, not just of the leader. And then there's the zeal and passion. It's not just a question of piety, it's an expression, religious expression of excitement that exists more with radicals than with moderates. And for better or worse, the modernists tend to be moderates. Maybe that goes along with modernity, I don't know. It's more appealing because people are excited about it. People get excited about what other people are excited about. And beyond the zeal, there's also simplicity to conservative religion. And the simplicity not in a bad sense, as in simple-mindedness, but I'm speaking about simplicity in the same way as what attracted Simone Weil, a French-Jewish thinker, who was very attracted and was closer to Catholicism than to Judaism, became closer. She was originally nothing at all. She was very involved with socialism, communism, and the last few years, she died very young, the last few years was attracted and very much involved with Catholicism. But what drew her initial attraction is when she went to Portuguese fishing villages and she saw midnight processions of peasant women. That's the simplicity that brings religious attraction, religious excitement. And without that, something which, again, the early Protestant sects did have, and for better or worse, does not exist in modernist Islam. Now, as far as a reformation in Islam, I think there actually may have been a successful reformation in Islam in the last 200 years. And that's really the move towards fundamentalism and conservative reinterpretation of Islam. To make things simple, and they're not at all simple, because Islam is extremely large, there's all sorts of groups involved. When we speak about fundamentalists, we can be speaking about Sunnis and Shiites, which are two different ballparks, even though there's certainly commonalities. We can speak about different regions, there's all sorts of, and different epochs. But be that as it may, to try to encapsulate what I'm speaking about, the Wahhabites who have been in really the ruling brand of Islam in Saudi Arabia for the last 200 years, by and large, have engineered a re-understanding, a reinterpretation, a new understanding of Islam as more conservative and more intense than it was in the interpreted in the past by traditional Islam. And that brand of Islam has really been the brand of Islam that's caught on in the last 50 years in most Muslim countries, certainly in most Arab countries, even though it itself is a reinterpretation. And its founder, alongside the modernists, told his followers, people have misinterpreted Islam over the last many centuries, over the last 1,000 years, between Muhammad and Muhammad ibn Abd al-Wahhab, who's the founder of Wahhabism. In that 1,000 years, said Wahhab, there's been tremendous misinterpretation. We have to go back to the sources. We have to go back to what Muhammad originally said. And in fact, this has swept up the Islamic world. It's funny, Al-Fadl says that it's a fact that Islam is living a period of reformation. It's only a question of who's going to win the reformation, that Islam is different, vastly different in the modern period than it was in pre-modern times, is a fact. The only question is who's going to determine the shape of contemporary Islam. Is it going to be the modernist like himself, or is it going to be the conservative fundamentalist? Again, it may be a question for him, in my mind as an outsider, it's not so much of a question. I was going to make the comparison on each point to modern Orthodoxy. I'm only going to do that briefly because we're running out of time, but I think on the counts where modernist Islam fails, the three criteria that I raised, modern Orthodoxy similarly fails to a large extent. Number one, the zeal, going backwards, the zeal and passion is something that unfortunately is lacking in the modern Orthodox world. I remember Rabbi Lam, Norman Lam, Chancellor of Yeshiva University, who can be described as one of the main leaders in modern Orthodoxy, speaks about passionate moderation. Right, it's a wonderful phrase, but unfortunately, I think it's a phrase that most modern Orthodox people simply don't get. Perhaps the paradox, and we'll speak more about paradox, is too great for it to be a popularly held concept. And although there are obvious exceptions, there are certainly passionate modern Orthodox rabbis and even laymen. But by and large, when I see passion in modern Orthodoxy, it tends to be more about modernity than it is about Orthodoxy. Likewise, in terms of piety, whether we're speaking about foolish piety or real piety, one sees less of it in modern Orthodoxy. And as I said before, perhaps that's simply because there's so much to gain in the Western world by being modern, such that it doesn't take much commitment to be ideologically modern Orthodox. And even in terms of the first point that we mentioned, about which I have more reservations, the question of whether modern Orthodoxy's ideas have strong basis in text and tradition, as I said, though I feel personally that that's much less of an issue than the other two, and perhaps even not an issue, nonetheless, we should perhaps listen to what's said by Gerald Blitzstein, writing favorably about democracy and Orthodoxy, that there's certainly room for democracy and Orthodoxy. That's what Gerald Blitzstein of Ben-Gurion University, a fine scholar and a modern Orthodox thinker, says. But he concludes his article in a very strange way, bringing us doubts that perhaps remind us of Liebman, another modern Orthodox academic, telling us that pursuing matters to the pure, consistent ends may demonstrate how irreconcilable the positions of halakha and liberal democracy really are. Says Blitzstein, maybe we shouldn't be too intellectually honest, because if we're too intellectually honest, we'll see that there really is a contradiction between liberal democracy and Torah. And since I don't want to come to that conclusion, therefore, as he says, let's not pursue the matter to their pure, consistent end. Perhaps that's a malady of modern Orthodoxy, this sort of ambivalence and looking over the shoulder and feeling that somehow we're not as good as the other guys. I remember speaking to another great leader and activist in modern Orthodoxy, who told me, I think you were there at the time, I don't know if you remember this, who told me that he has nightmares at night thinking that maybe he's misleading people. That maybe he's misleading people. So apparently, even though I don't feel it's an issue that there is a strong basis for most of the tenets of modern Orthodoxy in the text and the tradition, apparently it's not something that everyone feels. That's correct. That's correct. For different reasons. In any case, what is clear is that as in Islam, whether the reasons that I've brought are correct or not, as in Islam, in Orthodoxy, we see a move towards fundamentalism in the last 50 years, a move that, though people speak about changing trends, it's hard to see clearly that these trends are changing so quickly, even though there are certain nuances and all sorts of interesting and exciting things going on in both worlds. But what's more interesting, and I want to share an experience, I think this shows the ascendancy of Haredi thinking, especially on the issue that we started with, on the issue of religion and state, in at least the Dati Leumi world, which I think is becoming more and divided, more and more divided into a more conservative, small c, strain, which less and less identifies with Medinat Yisrael as it stands. I was at a forum in my neighborhood of Har Nof, excuse me, the evening of the meeting, this was early this year, the evening of the meeting of Hesder rabbis, discussing what to do about the conflict between the Minister of Defense, Ehud Barak, and Rev. Eliezer Melamed, questioning the policies of Yeshivat Har Bracha, one of the yeshivot, whether they were, in fact, eligible to be a Hesder Yeshiva because of their political position, which was really questioning the authority of the government to make certain decisions about evacuating settlers and giving up land. It was very interesting, in this meeting, the rabbi who hosted the forum clearly had a liberal agenda, an agenda with which I personally sympathized with, and it brought speaker after speaker to explain, from these Hesder rabbis, to explain, really the liberal wing of the Hesder rabbis, to explain why Judaism, Orthodox Judaism and Torah demand that we support the state, and that Siruv, for soldiers to decide that they will not listen to orders, is something that is against their vision of Judaism. One speaker after another came up and spoke about this from different perspectives, from a halachic perspective, from a mystical perspective, and so on and so forth. And I was noticing that though I was enjoying myself, the audience was getting more and more restless, and that each time they were allowed by the rabbi, who also probably felt the mood growing somewhat ugly, whenever he allowed a question, immediately the question was a challenging question, as if these rabbis were just a bunch of Uncle Toms who were compromising, were willing to compromise the more correct vision that's taking more and more hold of our ranks, and perhaps the easier position, that Judaism subscribes to complete identity of a religion and state, even in our context, and that any government law that is not in line with halakha, be it about Shabbat, be it about territorial compromise, is simply null and void, is simply something that we don't have to listen to. That opinion, that viewpoint, is ascendingly popular in the Dati Lumi world. And it's hard not to respect the people who hold it. Again, for the reasons that we mentioned before, it's hard not to respect the zeal and the passion, which mirrors the zeal and the passion, perhaps it even exceeds the zeal and the passion, of the Haredi world. And as such, if their doctrine is the reinterpretation of Judaism, as Haredi Judaism might also be, as much and perhaps more than modern Orthodoxy. Nonetheless, these tracts have, if the Reformation is a model, these tracts have more of a chance at successful reinterpretation. Again, the issue is not who's right and who's wrong. The question is, how can one be successful at reinterpreting and moving a tradition in a certain direction? The problem with these trends, the more conservative trends in Islam, and I'll wind down with this particular idea, the problem is that both in Islam as well as in Judaism, these conservative slash fundamentalist trends bring us to an impasse. They bring us to an impasse because the world is a pluralistic world. Medinat Yisrael is a pluralistic country. We're not living only with Orthodox Jews, nor are we even only living with Jews, which is one of the biggest challenges that Rabbi Chaim Herzog, first chief rabbi of Israel, attempted to deal with in trying to explain what a Torah state should look like, had to find all sorts of reasons why the halachic state would give equal rights to non-Jewish minorities, which again, in this particular case, is from my humble perspective, and I'm very far from the scholar that he was, seemed to be far-fetched reasons that were simply trying to get to a certain goal, and perhaps as a result were something that were bypassed by the secularists as something not necessary because there was nothing, it didn't add anything, and therefore there was really no need for it to begin with. But in any case, we have an impasse. We have an impasse if we're looking at the brands of Islam and Judaism that are successful, and if we're going to take the position that perhaps the sources in Judaism, which interest us more than Islam, are much thinner than the resources in Christianity in which we can support a tolerant, pluralistic state. And this, by the way, has some very serious ramifications, right? Cardozo wrote a few months back about what happens when Orthodoxy becomes a majority in Israel. And the answer is we're totally unprepared for that. We're completely unprepared. And it's something we need to think about seriously, because Judaism and liberal pluralism at this point don't really have a bridge. So if the moderates are not able to successfully reinterpret Judaism, the conservatives are not able to solve the problem. And so, Chozer Kushel LeDuchte, like we say in the Gemara, that the original question comes back and we're left without an answer. We only have a few minutes, and that's lucky for me because I don't have an answer either. I can only tell you the beginnings of some thoughts. I'm encouraged by something that's going on in political and liberal political thought the last 20, 25 years, something called multiculturalism, which is seeing that perhaps groups have rights as well as individuals. And it's true that Rabbi Jonathan Sacks recently wrote against the concept as being overly divisive. In Europe, I think that this is a concept with tremendous promise. Just to give you an idea of what people are saying, actually two Israeli writers who wrote about this topic over 15 years ago in the Journal of Social Research, a very important article by Moshe Halbertal, who most of you have probably heard, at least heard the name, as well as his teacher, Avishai Margalit, who's a philosopher, political philosopher. He puts it this way, he says, protecting cultures out of the human right to culture may take the form of an obligation to support cultures that flout the rights of the individual in liberal society. Meaning, all of a sudden, you have liberal thinkers, and these gentlemen, certainly Margalit, is clearly a liberal thinker. I mean, he was one of the founders of B'Tselem, which everybody knows is a left-wing pro-Palestinian, or at least people say pro-Palestinian, a human rights group certainly affiliated with far left, the Meretz. In any case, he, as a liberal, writes that in fact sometimes liberal rights don't take precedence over the rights of a group. And he says, tachlis, about the Haredim follows, which I think is extremely admirable. Sometimes we only see the excesses of people on the left, but it's kedai, it's worthwhile to hear what he wrote 15 years ago. It says as follows: closing the streets in ultra-Orthodox neighborhoods to traffic on the Shabbat is justified. The requirement that tourists or passerbys wear modest clothing in ultra-Orthodox neighborhoods, even during the hot summer days of Jerusalem and Bnei Brak, is likewise justified. Similarly, the ultra-Orthodox should be assisted in maintaining their educational institutions and their judicial autonomy in marital and family matters as long as their courts do not impose their norms on other Israeli citizens. Okay? So here are liberals, and they happen to be Israelis because I think it's most shocking for us, but there are many writers all over the world, in Canada, United States, in Europe, in Britain, who are taking this line that groups, even non-liberal, even anti-liberal groups, have rights as well. They have rights to a culture. And by pushing liberalism, which subverts their culture, then one is, in effect, stomping out their rights to their own culture. What I like about this is that there's a creativity, besides the fact that it's coming down from the arrogance of Western liberalism. If you read someone like John Rawls, for example, who finally, after many years, allowed religious people in a, I was really speaking about the United States, but in Western democracy, to voice their opinions, even though they're religiously grounded opinions, let's say, for example, abortion, they're allowed to take a position that abortion is wrong because God said so. They're allowed to take such a position, Rawls finally agreed, so long as they can argue it in secular terms. In other words, your position can be based on the Bible, the Quran, and the Torah, but you're not really allowed in the public sphere to discuss it as such, and rather you have to say that abortion is a threat to the family, and so on and so forth. So in any case, people who are coming from a perspective of multiculturalism are presenting us with a usefully creative idea. And that idea is that a contradiction can coexist. The two sections of the same society with contradictory values can live side by side. And perhaps this is what Rabbi Sacks questions and says that it's not working in England. Perhaps it's not working, I'm not sure, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But theoretically, there's something to go with here, because the impasse is not going to go away. There's a situation where religion, Orthodox, traditional religion, and by the way, Christianity hasn't said the last word either, as can be seen by the popularity of a book like Culture Wars in the United States, which speaks about the fact that there is an Orthodox vision of what American society should look like, which is completely at odds with the secular vision. The impasse exists internationally, it exists locally, and it's not going to go away. And without creative thinking, it will not go away. It will simply get worse and fester. And the confrontation we see locally, both in terms of what we saw in Gaza, right, with Hit Nat Kut, with the withdrawal, and things that continue to occur, and with Shabbat demonstrations, in my mind, can only get worse, because there's a lack of creativity as to how to solve the situation we're in. So if reinterpretation is not the most likely avenue to solving the impasse, perhaps, as we see in multiculturalism, the point is to invest in paradox, to accept paradox. And perhaps on this point, Jewish tradition has a lot to say. After all, a God who is both a God of mercy at the same time as being a God of judgment, who is both immanent and transcendent, who creates individuals whose identity is also merely part of a group while still being individuals, and tells us to pray even as he knows what's best for us. Surely such a religion, such a tradition, has a lot to say about things that seem to be mutually exclusive and yet coexist. Moshe Sokol, in an article, explores this idea, tracing it in the Maharal, in Rav Tzadok, in Rav Kook, as saying that everything coming from God cannot be in contradiction, in a very different way, that things, since all things emanate ultimately from God, then they ultimately are unifying. They ultimately do not contradict. That's right. That doesn't mean that there's no such thing as a contradiction. But it does mean that we perhaps need to explore the area of paradox more creatively, and not only to explore it in the laboratory in the Beit Midrash, but to show willingness to put it out there on the table and to actually organize our lives more in line with paradox. We organize ourselves according to the clear categories of Greek thought. And I'm not sure it's completely been successful. Perhaps it's time to re-examine the way we think and the way we organize our societies and our lives, and perhaps be willing to take experiments, to live in full appreciation of paradox, not contradiction, but in full appreciation of the truth of paradox, which we see in our tradition. So I just want to reiterate and perhaps summarize what we've discussed this evening. We started by looking at our neighbors, at Islamic modernists, and seeing that they're discussing many of the things that we in the modernist, the progressive Orthodox community are discussing. We looked specifically on the question of religion and state, and saw that the Christian tradition was successful in the Reformation because of certain factors that don't appear to exist in modernist Islam and don't exist to a large extent in modern or progressive orthodoxy. We said that they do appear more in conservative trends, which are really a reinterpretation of Islam, and perhaps in conservative trends both in the Haredi and Dati Lumi camps in Israel. The problem, we said, however, with these conservative trends is that they don't solve the problem of modernity, even on a day-to-day basis of how do you run your society. And as a result, what I said that we need to do is think in new ways and to accept the notion of paradox, perhaps as something more important than creative reinterpretation of the text. In either case, what I think needs to be taken is the clear need for anyone who's interested in presenting chidush, whether it be completely original, whether it be rooted in ancient ideas, in traditional ideas, that it goes nowhere without religious zeal, without passion, and most importantly, without Yiret Shamayim. And without those things, we don't have a prayer. Thank everyone for coming. If there's questions...
unsettling.
When David succeeded. Martin discussed these matters, he cited a non-Jewish theologian, Peter Berger. Yes. And Berger's thesis was that it's not one mindset. In other words, that there's a general attitude to how you find truths, and you have opposite ways in modern society. 100 years ago, whatever the realm was in life, what kind of food you eat, anything. You relied on tradition, your parents, your rabbis, the people who just carried on what was believed. But this is going out of fashion simply. In the last 100 years, the whole basis of a person's function is to question everything and then decide what you believe. And he claims that general attitude then spreads to religious things. That's just how you function. And if we do believe in the Torah, that God has a language that expresses the Torah in every language, one of those languages must be the criticalist speculating approach, which basically is that the problem.
Yeah, that's fine. I think my point is not so much content as much as style. And I think even assuming we have the content right, the approach right, without the style, it's not going to go anywhere.
I guess underlying theories that I always had about moderation in religions is that after they lose enough, they realize that they have to start fighting and try to find some way to compromise.
I mean, radicals. When radicals lose enough, or moderates lose enough?
Anybody loses. I mean, the group loses. a whole. The Peace of Westphalia, 17th century, is the end of the religious wars within the concept of religious wars. They went on to have another war. Within the concept of religious wars, they had simply failed it up both sides and had such tremendous losses that they just couldn't keep on going. In Judaism, it may have been, you know, the destruction of the temple. Gone away, come back, and you have in Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, you've got the holiness of Rabbi Apulis that leads us to the destruction of the temple. So it's holiness that leads us to the destruction. So the question becomes then whether or not in Islam that would be also. And I have a feeling, just 2 points. Number one, it seems that internally within Islam, they also accept the idea, I have heard, though I'm not a great Islamist, that in fact if they would lose their next thing, then they would give it all up to the Allah doesn't want them to continue making war. And secondly, this appears to be groups that have in fact lost enough so that there's Muslims in Kazan, the former Soviet Union, and in Wales, who have rejected jihad and violence as a mechanism for the religion to conquer its presence.
There's no question that catastrophe leads to change. Presumably, we're hoping to avoid that type of change. In other words, God's hand, you know, however you want to understand it, has a mechanism by which self-destruction leads to self-destruction, and something new has to grow out of it. What we're looking for, I think, is something before that. It's true that you don't have to have a Khurban Abayit for people to take the lesson that new approaches have to be taken. It's interesting because in the Islamic world, the Six-Day War is viewed as a turning point where the modernist, which wasn't clearly modernist, was socialist, nationalist approach in Arab countries, read Nasser, right, in Egypt, was seen as a failure and bankrupt. They had all these countries fighting against Israel, and they were the laughingstock of the world, militarily speaking. And as a result, that led to rethinking of a more secularist approach in the Islamic world, and ultimately gave tremendous breeding ground for the radical or at least fundamentalist Muslims like the Wahhabis. At the same time, and it's true, like we said about Judaism, there's all sorts of things going on both in the Islamic world and the Jewish world. I see the ascendancy of fundamentalism as still the dominant direction. And I'm not sure that reinterpretation or calamity, because we're not talking about, I think Saudi Arabia is a much better model than Al-Qaeda. And Saudi Arabia, on many levels, is successful. Many levels not, but as opposed to Al-Qaeda, who, you know, eventually they'll run themselves out of blood and men. But in any case, it's not clear that that's what's, at least from my perspective, that's what we can expect in the near future.
There have been reformations in Islam and in Judaism, and you didn't actually mention them, which sort of changed the whole thing. I mean, I'm thinking of the Sufi movement in Islam and the Zohar and its effect on what we thought was Judaism before it became dominant. So, I mean, these things did work, and they may not have been modernist in that sense, although Sufism does have a lot of modernistic affinity. I don't know whether you think that these are models that we could look at as to how change takes place. They think from within rather than from without.
Right. I think Hasidut might be an even better example in the sense that Hasidut was a mass movement as opposed to De Kabbalah. So if you want to view it as a continuous trend, fine. It's interesting because I almost made some sort of note about Sufis. Everybody loves a Sufi. I was at an interreligious meeting here in Yerushalayim with all sorts of different peoples, and the Islamic representative was obviously a Sufi. Now, if you don't know anything about Sufism, it tends to be very politically docile, and therefore it's no great feat to invite a Sufi to sit together with Jews in West Jerusalem. The problem with Sufis, and I think this is really the issue, is creating a mass movement, creating a mass following, and anytime you're involved with esoterics, I mean, I think the examples you gave in terms of Kabbalah and Sufism, anytime you're involved with an esoteric doctrine, you know, a mystical, complicated doctrine, it prevents a mass following for the obvious reasons, which are not reasons that I mentioned today. In other words, the zeal might be there, the passion might be there, and it may have resonance in the original sources. But from its very inception, it's designed to be an elite movement. Not to say elite movements can't have impact, but what we're talking about here is a dominant mass religious movements. By the same token, so the Hasidic movement, again, I would separate between the two. So I think the Hasidic movement is a good example of a successful reformation in Judaism. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay,
so
right. Right.
Okay, I'm not sure I understand your question, but let me try.
Two different things between government,
yeah,
state,
right.
Not narratives, right. And being a liberal,
right.
As opposed to being a Haredi or whatever,
right.
Model,
right.
Whatever you want to call
Allah, right. Right. So let me try to answer.
How do you blend
right.
Both in?
Right.
I think it's almost impossible.
Okay. First of all, the word liberal. Can be used in different contexts and mean different things.
I'm talking political liberal.
Okay, so that also can mean two different things.
Well, anybody who's more liberal means, you know,
right, okay. let me explain. Let me explain. When I'm speaking about liberalism, I'm speaking about classical liberalism, political trend, which views the individual as having rights and the basic building block of society. I think that conservatives in America today are stronger liberals in a classical sense than are, quote, liberals, okay? So in other words, Republicans are more true to traditional classical liberalism than are liberals who have reinterpreted the word. So to clarify, that's what I was speaking about, classical liberalism. There's also, the word can also be used synonymously as having a more expansive vision of religion, right? More willingness to understand things in a variety of flexible ways. I wasn't really speaking about that. Now, whether one can be a classical political liberal and an Orthodox Jew, I think that Rav Shimshon Flora Hirsch is a very good example of one. He's clearly accepted and very much with passion.
Even in Eretz Yisrael?
Again, there certainly are people who define themselves that way. I think it is possible. Again, it's a much longer talk. There are all sorts of articles have been written by all sorts of people. Avi Ravitsky is one example, and just one out of many. Professor Avi Ravitsky should have a Refuah Shleima. Wrote an interesting book that says that the reason we think that we have to have Medinat Halakha, we have to have a state that enforces Halakha, is because we're stuck on the Rambam's vision of what the Jewish state is supposed to look like. He says, if you look at the Drashot HaRan, the 11th Drasha, you'll see a completely different vision of what a Jewish state needs to be, one which is very divorced from halacha, right? And one can argue with Ravitsky on the Ran, but there's certainly a legitimate reading in the Ran. And Professor Ravitsky would tell you, why the Rambam, why not the Ran? If you go with the Ran, and he also quotes Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski as following this approach, as opposed to Rav Herzog, an exchange of letters that they had, that we can accept the Medina as it is, whether it would be a monarchy or a democracy is really has very little to do with Judaism, according to at least that point in Levitsky. And you have other people, like Josh Berman recently wrote a book claiming to find all sorts of liberal notions within the Torah itself. So that people have certainly espoused that. My point is that it's not for lack of creativity or for lack of approaches that we can't espouse such a position. The problem is that the people who espouse this position, and this is the problem with modernists in general, simply don't have the right stuff. Right? And the right stuff, as I said, more than textual interpretation and cleverness and wisdom, has to do with sociological factors that have to do with the sociology of religion. What makes for a successful religion? Yeah, go ahead.
Shibarov, I just want to, can you explain what it means for someone to be a classical liberal but still be a Camino Orthodox Jew? Like
yeah, refer. So it's interesting. Again, we perhaps, and I agree that the combination is not simple. It's I sometimes wonder, and I wish Rabbi Hirsch had written more about it. If you're going to take a classical approach to the Jewish tradition, that the group is more important than the individual. That there is authority, that there is hierarchy, there are certain given roles and limitations based on your sex, based on your birth, based on your tribe. It's very difficult to see how that can work alongside a liberal state. And it's certainly complicated when it's your own state. And it's even more complicated, it's interesting, it's even more complicated when you run the state. It's less complicated if you can hide and say, as many have, we're not in charge. So it's a moot point. What happens when we are in charge? So it's a very important question. And again, demographic trends tell us that we're not prophets. We may one day be in charge, and we have not the foggiest notion, I think, of what to do with that. I'll take one more question. You waited patiently.
Comparing modern Orthodoxy with Islam and Judaism, it seems to me that there's a huge gulf that was decided. The issues of modern Orthodoxy or Conservative Orthodoxy are things like more hours of secular studies in a school, or mixed eating in a synagogue, or celebrating Yom HaTzmaut. In Islam, issues are, do we conquer the world, blow anybody who's not a Muslim? Do we keep slaves? Do we have honor killings? These are the issues.
I don't think that's correct.
Comparisons are a huge gulf.
Respectfully, I don't know how much you've read. The readings I've seen, it depends also what you mean by the radicals. If you're talking about Al-Qaeda, if you're talking about certain terrorist groups, and I don't even think we're talking about the majority or even the vast majority of Hamas, and I don't want to get political, that's not really the gap. The gap is citizenship for minorities. That's an issue. The gap is corporal punishment. These are the type of issues that are being argued between serious conservatives. Again, for a less difficult example, think Saudi Arabia. Think of the clergy in Saudi Arabia. And the liberals like El Fado. Yes, there are extremists. There's Neturei Karta here also. If you want to think of Neturei Karta as representatives of the Haredi world, you get a very different picture than if you look at the whole expanse and the middle point of where the Haredi world is.
I'm not an expert either, but my impression is that the average mosque in the Middle East preaches more things that I raised than not.
Okay, not so sure. But regardless, I want to thank everyone for coming. There's various things in the back. There's some books for sale. There's information for free. And I'll be here for a few more minutes. I'm happy to take questions in the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The last thing is also a comparison to the fundamentals.